From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on a train to Nashville, Tennessee, in the summer of 1920. Women's suffrage was on the line. It had passed Congress, but it had to be ratified by the states. There were 48 states at the time, with 36 states, three quarters, needing to approve suffrage to ratify it. 35 states had gotten on board. They needed one more. It all came down to Tennessee, decades of work, lifetimes of struggle, all to create the Susan B. Anthony Amendment, to pass woman suffrage. On that train was a woman determined to win the fight. She had been inspired by her mother, who gave her a dying wish to stand firm on the issue of women and the vote. She would organize, agitate, do whatever it took. And so, would you be surprised, as I was, to learn that this woman was on the way to Nashville in order to oppose woman suffrage? Of the many fascinating details in Elaine Weiss's new book called The Woman's Hour, this one captivated me the most. It was the story of the so-called antis, the women who thought that women should not be voting, that it would lead to the moral decay of this nation, that it was a man's place to do that kind of work. Well, you know how the 19th Amendment turned out, but you probably don't know the story of how it got there. Elaine Weiss is coming to Rochester to give the keynote address at the annual luncheon for the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. But first, she is on the line and our guest on Connections. Elaine, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm very pleased to be with you.
It's great to have you here. Also with us in studio is Deborah Hughes, Executive Director of the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. Deborah, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan. It's great to be here.
And here as well is Randy Gorbin, WXXI News Director, for a brief hello. Hi, Mr. News Director.
Hello, Mr. Talk Show Host. Good to talk to you, Evan.
Exactly right.
Well, I want to say once again, just another great hour. You know, we've done a lot of reporting about women's suffrage and recent issues involving women, as we did last hour, talking about some of the discrimination issues in Hollywood and, of course, some great historical data, I'm sure, coming up this hour. But again, this is all part of what we do here, and it does take resources to do it. A few times a year, we come to you and ask you to please contribute whatever you can to keep things going, to help us progress. We've got some great projects in the works, but again, it will take some funding to do that. You can make a donation any amount at 454-6300, 454-6300. The toll-free number, 1-800-295-9994. That's 1-800-295-9994. Or if you just want to do it online, you can do that safely and securely at WXXINews.org. Whatever you can to continue great programming like Connections here on WXXI. Most appreciated, Evan.
All right, Randy, thank you very much. Well, you've got the event coming up on February 14th, Deborah Hughes, is that right?
That's next Wednesday, yes.
Next Wednesday. Why don't you tell us what's going on?
Well, first of all, February 14th this year is the bicentennial of the date Frederick Douglass chose as his birthday. So in addition to celebrating Susan B. Anthony's birthday, which really was the next day, the 15th, we'll be doing both together, celebrating in this bicentennial year. It's a luncheon we've been doing for more than four decades. People can get tickets at susanb.org. or by calling 279-7490. We're very excited to have Elaine Weiss as our keynote speaker.
Elaine Weiss, and the book is The Woman's Hour. And I want to ask you first, Elaine, why you wanted to write this story now. I said at the top of the hour here, we're coming up on a big anniversary, and certainly most people, I mean, most Americans understand how the 19th Amendment turned out, but these are stories in this book that I had never heard before. Why put the book out now?
Precisely because they're stories you haven't heard before. I have to say that I began research for this book almost 5 years ago, and my intention was to tell a fuller story of how American women fought for the vote. And it's something we just don't learn about in school in any kind of depth. It's something, there are very few narrative histories about it. We have a kind of cartoonish idea that there's Seneca Falls and there's ladies in hoop skirts, and then maybe there's a few picket signs somewhere along the line, and then we have the vote. And the struggle, the political and social struggle that it entailed for three generations of activists is just kind of glossed over. And so I wanted to tell that story to allow my countrymen to understand how democracy was made more perfect, in at least a small way. But it wasn't the small thing. It was half of the nation was enfranchised without any bloodshed, which is kind of unusual, actually, in the entire world, to have that many millions of people win their political freedom in a nonviolent way. So I wanted to tell that story, and then I wanted to concentrate on the last chapter of the story, which is the ratification of the Susan B. Anthony Amendment, the 19th Amendment. And it just happens that that story is cinematically dramatic and scary and full of characters and twists and turns. And it's not the way you would think legislation is, or a constitutional amendment is necessarily enters into our Constitution. So I wanted to tell the story, but what I did not know when I started out, and I did not know through the writing of it, was that it was going to arrive in this historical moment, in this moment when women are again feeling they need to stand up and fight for rights that, frankly, we thought were ensured. And the whole nation is being made aware not only of women's rights, which are threatened, but also voting rights and all sorts of rights that come up in this book that are essential elements of our democracy and are once again in question. And so it arrives, somewhat to my surprise, at a time when, in fact, we need this story. We need to know how another generation handled it.
Well, listeners, if anybody is wondering if a story about an amendment can be compelling, just remember it was like 4 or 5 years ago that Spielberg's film Lincoln came out, which was all about an amendment, and it was plenty dramatic. And this book is beautifully written, Elaine. It's wonderful narrative nonfiction. You put us right on the train. You take us right into those halls. And I want to set the scene a little bit to remind our listeners what I had to learn myself, because, again, this is mostly new to me. So they needed 36 states that summer, and you had 35 states, and it came down to North Carolina and Tennessee, and you write that North Carolina was a sure bet to say no, so it left only Tennessee. So tell me about some of the dynamics, including who the suffs and the antis were.
Ah, okay. So, again, it needs 36 states, three quarters, and the suffragists do not want to have this decisive battle in Tennessee because it is it's a southern state, and there's actually some state laws that will make considering the ratification more complicated. There's a governor who really does not want to deal with it. He's up for re-election. He doesn't want to deal with it, and the suffragists themselves in that state are very, very fractured. So there's not they're strong, but they're fractured. So it's just the worst case scenario for the suffragists. But they realize that if they don't get the amendment ratified by this 36th state, what that will mean is that, first of all, women will not be able to vote in the 1920 election. And the 1920 election was a pivotal one because it was the first one after World War I. And the nation was really deciding its role in the world. It was deciding whether it was going to join the League of Nations. It was coming off an unpopular war, and there was resistance to it. It was deciding about immigration. Does this all sound familiar? It was deciding about women's roles in society. And so there were large issues coming up, and women who had really participated in World War I in a way that women had not participated before, were saying, okay, we deserve the vote now. And Congress, after 40 years of delay, finally says, okay, and they pass the amendment, and now it's going, for the last year and a half, had been going through the states. So this is not the optimal scenario for the suffragists, because they know it's going to be a hard state. And they also know if they lose momentum, not only will women not be able to vote in the 1920 election and be a part of the decision-making of the course of the country for the next generation, pretty much, but momentum was beginning to swing against them. Since the spring, there had been several more rejections of the amendments, and there had been no other ratifications. And the anti-suffragists were really putting their all into this. They were just, this was their last stand, and they were going to pull out all the stops. And the nation was beginning to swing into a more conservative mode. It had gone through the Progressive Era. It had gone through all kinds of interesting reforms. And now people were getting a little wary of it. And they, you could tell that there was a social mood that if it didn't pass now, if the 19th Amendment didn't pass now, it might not be able to pass. So there was a lot riding on this. The suffragists, of course, come out of the 19th century, and they are a fascinating amalgam of small-town women and educated college women and school teachers, and it goes across the board. It's grown into a huge movement. More than 2 million women are associated with the suffrage movement, are sort of card-carrying suffragists. But the suffrage movement in America is split in 1920. There's a sort of mainstream group. This often happens in social and reform movements, and we see it in the women's movement today, and we see it in the civil rights movement, where there's a split among people who have the same goal, but they are they differ on their tactics and their strategies. And so we have two wings of the suffrage movement working towards the same goal, but working separately and working sometimes across purposes with each other and tripping each other up. And so when the three women come to Nashville on that night in July of 1920, and as you mentioned, one of them is Josephine Pearson, who is head of the Tennessee State Association opposed to women's suffrage. And the other two are represent the two wings of the suffrage movement. And like you, I found the anti-suffragists the most fascinating group of women who I had no idea existed. I think before I started this, I could not have imagined that there would be an organized group of women who opposed the enfranchisement of their own sex, who did not want their own sisters to have rights, who did not believe that women should not only shouldn't vote, but they literally should stay home.
Do you mind? Can I read from your book a little bit on this?
Please do.
So this is her detailing as she introduces Josephine Pearson, who is one of the antis, and I'm going to read from the book here. In the opening to Nashville, quote, she was 52 years old, and all of her training, college graduate degrees, and her years as an educator had prepared her for this mission. She knew she was doing God's will, fulfilling a sacred vow to her beloved mother, who had understood the dangers of female suffrage, how it mocked the plan of the Creator, undermined women's purity and the noble chivalry of men, and threatened the home and the family. The Bible said a woman's place was in the home, as loving wife and mother, not in the dirty realm of politics, not in the polling booth or in the jury box, where her delicate sensibilities could be assaulted, her morals sullied, and even corrupted. Her men knew what was best for her, would protect and cherish her, make laws and decisions for her benefit. Pearson felt there was no need to question the wisdom of Tennessee men or Tennessee laws. But the threat went beyond this. Woman suffrage could upend the supremacy of the white race and the Southern way of life. End quote. Wow. And this is not just Josephine Pearson. I mean, as Kirkus Reviews notes in their review of this forthcoming book, people are going to be surprised. Some modern readers are going to be surprised that this was not men leading that fight. I mean, there were certainly many men leading that fight, but there were women working very hard against suffrage. That really moved me. It was fascinating, in a weird way, fascinating to me, I would say.
Yes. Yes. And my job was to, both for my own research, to begin to understand where are they coming from, why are they doing this, and not make them cartoonish.
Yeah.
Because the arguments that they put forward can seem ridiculous to us today, saying not only that women should be stay at home, that they will be corrupted by going into the polling place and going outside the domestic sphere, but also that they actually thought that this was going to be the downfall of the entire Christian civilization, as they put it. Now, the thing that really surprised me was how much beyond that kind of social conservative aspect of their opposition, there was also a racial element in the South. There were Northern women, certainly. In fact, the opposition, the national opposition, is centered in the North, in New York and in Boston. But in the South, it has definite racial overtones. And basically, to put it bluntly, they don't want black women voting. They don't want black men voting. And they've, since the Reconstruction, they have been pretty successful in prohibiting black men from voting, both by violence and intimidation and poll taxes and literacy, outrageous literacy and character tests. And they're worried that they may not be able to do the same thing, intimidate black women with impunity. And so turns out they will, but at this point, they are very worried about having black women enter the vote, have the right to vote and enter the political process. So there are so many strains going on, even within the anti-suffrage movement. But they are the precursors of what we see today, which is opposition to things that you might think that women would support, but because of religious and social conservative philosophy, they really will not. And so I think we see the seeds of this social and politically conservative movement that has been ascendant in America for the last several years.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you see modern analogs that are sort of faint echoes of the antis of 1920, or if you think that is a direct link there. And as you mentioned, maybe there are issues that you would, in your own words, expect women to support, but some do not. What is an example?
To try not to be too controversial, I would say health care for all. I would think that maternal health and children's welfare and the CHIP, anything from the CHIP program to rational and affordable health care would be a woman's issue. And there are elements, there are large swaths of women who do not support that. And I find that I would consider that an interesting but counterintuitive stand to take. There's also reproductive rights, and I don't want to go deeply into that, but I do believe that I find it hard to square. I know that there are religious and social precepts that prevent acceptance of that, and I appreciate that. And we see the same thing in Tennessee. There are religiously conservative women who say this is not God's plan. God made women to be subservient. He made Eve to be subservient to Adam, and we cannot go against that. And they use the Bible to justify not giving women the vote. And we do see that, echoes of that today. Something that I came to realize when I was writing the afterword was that actually there is a direct line from the anti-suffragists to the modern conservative woman. And I won't draw that out completely for you now, but there is a line of conservative women activists who really learned, sort of cut their teeth on the suffrage movement, and went on and became stronger and more organized and more sophisticated, and were able to both thwart certain legislation in the years to come, and also became strong in what we would call politically conservative issues, and that anti-communism, against the ERA. These women, there really is a very strong maternal line, and it's really fascinating. The suffragists, on the other hand, really do fall apart after after suffrage is won, and that's because it's such a big tent that they really didn't have another issue to coalesce. But the conservative women do.
Yeah, and so I thought that was interesting to kind of learn what happened to the antis after 1920. It's not like they just dissolved and
they got stronger.
There are many issues in which they were stronger. But before we talk a little bit more about that, let me just sort of try to as best I can, think about what a modern conservative woman might say to some of your comments here, Elaine, because I know you don't want to overly politicize this. You're just simply looking at what you view are historical data and analogs here. And it's whether we want to sort of grapple with this or not, we speak a little bit too monolithically about who elected whom, et cetera, et cetera. But it is true that white women voted for Donald Trump. White suburban American women voted for Donald Trump. And I still expect, Elaine, that a lot of white suburban voters, women who voted for Donald Trump, would say, okay, but we would never have been in league with the antis. We would never have stood against a woman's right to vote. We have a very different view than the antis had 100 years ago, and connecting us is unfair. What might you say to that?
Yeah, I do not want to make, it's very hard to do that kind of retrospective analysis, and I don't mean to do that at all. I'm just saying that there were for the women antis, for the women who opposed suffrage for their own sisters and fellow women citizens. There were not. It was a complicated set of factors that led them to this, and there were. Both political, social, cultural, and religious aspects to their opposition. And I'm just saying that constellation of influences are still present today. I think that's all I'm trying to say.
My guest is Elaine Weiss, the author of the forthcoming book, The Woman's Hour, The Last Furious Fight to Win the Vote. And she will be here next Wednesday, Debbie Hughes, right?
Correct. February 14th at the Rochester Riverside Convention Center. The luncheon's from noon till 1:30.
Noon to 1:30, and people can register and get tickets where?
Online at susanb.org or call 279-7490.
I'll take a phone call in just a second. Michelle and East Aurora, stay right there. But I wanted to ask Deborah Hughes to kind of weigh in here and let us know what you think about this notion that this moment in 1920, I think Elaine sets the book up pretty well, because she's just noting that many people assume, well, Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, these towering figures worked for decades, and then in 1920, you know, the country said, okay, and the women got the right to vote, and we all moved on and lived happily ever after. And that Elaine's book shows us it was certainly not that simple. There were difficult coalitions to create, and it was by no means certain at that time. If this hadn't gone that way, Deborah, we wouldn't be sitting here 98 years later and with women not voting, I don't think. But how much more time do you think, Deborah, we would be talking about here before woman suffrage happened in this country?
Well, we're still talking about voting rights in this country. And to me, that's the fascinating piece. And I'm intrigued by the groups like the anti-suffragists who may have had a stated agenda, but I'm more interested in who's manipulating them. And that's the parallel that I see with our current day. So, for example, the ways that we know the 2016 election, we used fear and anxiety on different levels to motivate different groups. One of the motivators was to say to people, you know, let's be afraid of the immigrant. Let's be afraid of the person who looks different or talks differently. Let's be afraid of the politics they might have brought from their former country. And let's find the people who we can get enough distressed about that they're either not going to show up to vote or they'll show up to vote the opposite way. And I see a lot in the 1920 period that the suffragists and the anti-suffragists, the race was a great card. You know, you're saying to white women, you don't want to give all women the right to vote. All of these black women will come out to vote, and now the formerly enslaved people will outnumber the former slave owners right here in a number of the states in the South. So panic, oh my gosh, what will happen with that? Another huge motivator was, what about all of these immigrant women who've now become naturalized? They come with all kinds of beliefs. There was a very strong anti-Catholic movement in the anti-suffragists, very strong anti-labor movement. What if you give all of these working class people the right to vote? We're going to end up like a socialist country. So I'm fascinated that often the forces that did not want to have social change would figure out the right messaging to get people to vote the way they want them to vote, and we didn't even acknowledge we were being manipulated.
Okay. Well, Elaine, what about you? What do you think is the likely outcome of woman suffrage if Tennessee had not gone the way of the suffs in 1920?
Yes, I think that what likely would have happened, I'm not going to say we wouldn't be voting today if it didn't happen. There was actually no sunset on the, there was no time limit on ratification, unlike the ERA years later, which comes directly out of this, by the way. The same women write the ERA just 3 years later. It has been sitting in Congress for 95 years. But I think because the nation was beginning to swing into a more conservative frame of mind, Warren Harding was elected in the fall of 1920. Warren Harding plays a big part in the book. And he wants to bring America back to days of normalcy, as he calls it. In fact, his campaign slogan is America First. So there you have it.
Never heard it.
Yeah, right. There are some very striking and unnerving parallels. But what I think would have happened is there were states like Vermont and New Hampshire, Vermont and Connecticut, who the legislatures were willing perhaps to ratify, but the governors were not allowing, were not going to call their legislatures into session to do it. And there were economic and corporate forces that were at play in this and not allowing them to do that. So I think if the suffragists had lost Tennessee, you would have seen an emboldened anti-movement. And as it was, they had a whole team of lawyers who were contesting the ratifications in other states. They were actually trying to get these states to rescind their ratification. They were lodging lawsuits. And in fact, a lawsuit really does go up to the Supreme Court and isn't settled till 1922. So there's going to be a large pendulum swing coming, and there's going to be increased efforts and enthusiasm on the part of the anti-suffragists to thwart ratification. And I think it would have been delayed possibly for another decade at least. Hmm. And then, who knows? We have the Depression. We have all kinds of issues that might not have allowed for a space for this to be considered again. I'm not saying we wouldn't have had suffrage, but it would have been delayed. And I have to say my state of Baltimore refused to ratify.
Okay,
it didn't ratify, and it actually sent emissaries to Tennessee to convince those legislators to reject the amendment. Mm. So I think we would have seen a kind of surge in the anti-suffrage movement if they had lost Tennessee.
We have a lot of listeners' questions and comments. So, Michelle in East Aurora, Tom in Greece, we're going to get your phone calls right after our only break of the hour. The book that's in my hand, The Woman's Hour, The Last Furious Fight to Win the Vote, is our subject of discussion. The author is Elaine Weiss. She's coming to Rochester next Wednesday for the annual luncheon for the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. She'll be the keynote speaker. The book's not on sale for another month. I've got an advance uncorrected proof. I found no spelling errors, and I promised to burn the book after this interview. But the book will be on sale 1 month from today, The Woman's Hour. Let's get that break, and we'll come back with author Elaine Weiss and your phone calls next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, the doomsday clock has advanced. It's a symbol of scientific concerns about the end of the world. And last month, the clock was set to 2 minutes to midnight, the closest to midnight it has been since 1953. Scientists say if world leaders don't respond to threats of nuclear war and climate change, the effects could be irreversible. We'll discuss it then in our second hour. A new multimedia art series explores racial justice. Our guests share the meaning behind their work. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. A little history, and a kind of history that many of us don't know. And Randy Gorbin, news director of WXXI, I'm learning a lot this hour. Of course, the Susan B. Anthony Amendment that passed in 1920 that gave national woman suffrage is well known, but not the story behind it. And sometimes that's what we try to do here, peel back the stories that we only know the surface about, Randy, and kind of dig into the stuff that we did not know.
Fascinating hour, Evan, and really the kind of topics that we love to delve into. We have the time to do here in WXXI. We are public broadcasting, of course, in Rochester, and just with the kind of format that we have and the kind of people that we have, like Evan Dawson, Megan Mack, doing the kind of research we have on these shows, we want to continue doing that, but to do that, we need your support. This is really basically a member-supported station. We get money from some other sources, but really membership and people who have private contributions, really the biggest share of what we do here, so we need your help. We ask for it a few times a year. You can offer whatever you can right now at 454-6300, 454-6300. You can do it online, 1-800-295-9994, 1-800-295-9994, or you can do that online as well, wxxinews.org. We hope you'll continue to support great programming like Connections and Evan Dawson on WXXI. Evan?
All right, Randy, thank you very much. I want to get to some of our listener phone calls. Michelle in East Aurora plans to be there next Wednesday at the luncheon. Go ahead, Michelle.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I'm excited to hear Ms. Weiss speak at the luncheon next week. She had mentioned earlier that women were working at cross purposes towards common goals. And we know today abortion divides two categories of feminists, the pro-life feminist and the pro-choice feminist. And there was an op-ed in the Washington Post recently by Democrat David Brooks, who spoke about the extreme position of abortion rights feminists who, in his opinion, are threatening the Democratic Party and will set women back. And I'm looking for Ms. Weiss's thoughts on that.
Go ahead, Elaine.
Well, I'm not going to actually jump into that that question. I think there are no group is a monolith. I think we've learned that. I think you know that from your own organizations. There are going to be different strands. There are going to be different ideas. I am a strong advocate of women's rights to choose. I have no equivocation about that. But I understand other aspects. I just hope they would respect. I respect their attitudes and their wishes on that. But I would hope they would respect mine just as fully. So I think every organization, whether it's a Democratic Party or a feminist organization, has to deal with those kind of differences of opinion. And it's sometimes the split can actually hasten positive change. Sometimes it can retard it, but I think sometimes it can actually hasten it.
Well, let me ask Deborah Hughes, who is here from the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House as the executive director. Deborah, before the hour began, I made a remark that was incorrect. You corrected me on. I said you were apolitical, and you said it's not that we're apolitical; it's that we are nonpartisan.
Nonpartisan,
right?
Correct.
So, and in these days, in sort of this American political moment, is it hard to be nonpartisan?
It is hard to be nonpartisan. You know, what occurred to me while we were just listening to Elaine is the nuclear freeze movement from the 1970s. Mm. And I remember very well that, you know, the debate was should we be escalating to prevent Russia from dropping a bomb, or should we be de-escalating and getting rid of nuclear weapons? And I was a part of protests and movements. And finally, in a class that I was taking called Adventures in Peace Studies at the University of Oregon, the professor got everybody on both sides and asked us what was it that we really wanted. And the class was unanimous that we didn't want anyone to drop a nuclear bomb, and that terrified us. What we disagreed about was how do you get there? And so for some people, it was, well, we have to have the biggest, strongest bomb so no one else will use theirs. And for others, it was, if as long as these exist, there's a risk of an accident or someone will use it. I think that where we've lost track as we discuss about feminism and reproductive freedom is I'd like to know what the end is that people are looking for. Because I believe right now, you know, if you look at the Susan B. Anthony list, which we've talked about before, a political action organization that uses Susan B. Anthony's name, and we get dragged into the conversation a lot, they're celebrating the appointment of court justices who have a particular lean. So that's the whole question about exactly what are we talking about here? Are we talking about best outcomes for health for women and children? Are we talking about moral ethic? And if so, then are we willing to apply that moral ethic everywhere? And I think that we are not concentrated on what's the point. Hmm. That's the question I would raise.
All right. Let me get Tom in Greece on the line next. Go ahead, Tom.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Were black men allowed to vote in Tennessee in 1920? And if not, what did the white suffragists think about that?
Go ahead, Elaine Weiss.
That's an excellent question. Some were allowed to vote. Black men were allowed to vote. Sometimes a political organization, for instance, in Memphis, there was a sort of party leader, a Democratic Party leader named Boss Crump, who had surprisingly progressive ideas as long as they enhanced his power, and his organization would pay the poll tax for black voters, black men voters, and with the understanding that they would, vote his way. That, again, the poll tax was a barrier, and many, many black men were being disenfranchised by, again, poll tax, literacy and character, and even residency laws. I mean, the kind of voter suppression we see, unfortunately, being exercised in states today was being exercised then, and again against voters who the predominant party felt would be a threat. So it's the same dynamic. The suffragists, the white suffragists who were in Tennessee, whether native Tennesseans or those from outside who came for the ratification fight, were, I think, not strong enough in defending both black men and black women's right to vote. And some even used the rationalization when talking to Southern legislators who might have been racist. And they used, the suffragists did stoop to racist arguments, saying, look, there are actually more white women in the South than black women and men together. So if you give women the vote, it's going to help your white supremacy. So that kind of rationale would give me a chill when I read about it, and it gave me a chill when I had to write about it. But it was certainly the case. There were absolutely racist suffragists also. I also detail a fascinating collaboration in Tennessee between a few of the white women Tennessee suffragists and black Tennessee suffragists and how they worked together to try to get some legislation passed and get black women registered to vote. So there's some lovely little glimmers of sunlight in that story, but for the most part, the suffragists were so intent on getting the vote for themselves, they were willing to make some moral compromises, which I think we would view rather negatively today.
And so before I get back to our phone calls, a couple of listener questions on the subject of what was going on in 1920. Again, if you're just joining us, the book, The Woman's Hour, The Last Furious Fight to Win the Vote, is about what it took to get the 19th Amendment through. The ratification required 36 of the 48 American states. They had 35, and they needed one more. It came down to Tennessee, and the book tells the story of that fight, the battles that were going on, and the pressure on all sides. And Deborah Hughes, you sort of hinted earlier what was going on in Rochester. What did Rochester think about suffrage in 1920?
Well, in 1917, when New York passed suffrage for women, Rochester didn't vote the majority for it. I think, and some of these issues were also being played out here as well in Rochester. In Rochester, we also had some concerns about immigrants and whether you were empowering the Italians and empowering other groups. And there were some arguments that carried the day there. There was also a real class argument that said, do you want to empower people who are working class and have not had an education? Isn't governing too complicated to just have the commoner be involved in it? Of course, Susan B. Anthony always felt that's a risk you have to take if you're going to be a democracy, and that's really important. I think people do sometimes lose track of the fact that the 19th Amendment, as well as the 15th Amendment, don't actually guarantee rights for voting. They say that states can't prevent certain classes of people from voting. So just as with the 15th Amendment, which said that no male person could be denied the right to vote on the basis of prior servitude, so that was why Frederick Douglass was for the 19th Amendment. The 15th Amendment. Susan B. Anthony opposed the 15th Amendment because she really felt the only outcome following the Civil War should be universal suffrage, that everyone who was a citizen should be able to vote. And so that's a great debate that we still take on. The 19th Amendment also, in its wording, followed the pattern of the 15th Amendment. It said a woman couldn't be denied the right to vote on the basis of her sex. So it didn't say every woman could vote. You could now discriminate still with poll taxes or literacy tests or other ways, and it wasn't until the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And still, in our Constitution, states get to set the gate for who can register and show up to vote, whether it's through a voter ID, whether it's through photo IDs or whatever. And it's only when we put something through the Constitution that we can make sure they can't put up a barrier.
Hmm. Elaine, a listener named Jerry writes to the program and wants to know how the southern states voted on woman suffrage.
Well, most of the southern states rejected the Susan B. Anthony Amendment. And by the way, in the South, it was always called the Susan B. Anthony Amendment to inspire opposition to it. Because Susan B. Anthony in the South was known as a great supporter of abolition and as a great friend of Frederick Douglass, which she was. And so she was used in the campaigns in the South as a sort of boogeyman. Do you want to support a constitutional amendment named after this woman who was so anathema to everything the South stands for? So it was actually fascinating to see how present Susan is in this ratification fight years after she dies. But the southern states, except for I think Arkansas actually ratified and Texas ratified, but all the other states of the Confederacy rejected it, including some border states and some above the Mason-Dixon line states like Delaware. And there you see another influence that the antis bring to the situation, which is corporate money. Again, we've never heard of this, but there's dark money in this fight. There are sort of, there's money being pumped in, and some of the sources they know, like the liquor industry, is very dead set against women being able to vote because they have historically supported temperance. And prohibition has just gone into effect, like just a few months before. So prohibition is a big topic still. And what the liquor industry is hoping that it won't be enforced and that if they can get enough, as I call them, wet candidates at both the state and the federal level in the Congress, then it really won't be enforced too vigorously. But they fear if women come in, then it will be. manufacturers are pumping money into the anti-suffrage campaign because they fear that women might want regulations and maybe even the abolition of child labor. And they need child labor for their bottom line. They need cheap labor. And so they don't want women voting because of that. And they, especially in Tennessee, they actually give their employees the day off and ship them to the Capitol to, stand up against the amendment. The railroad industry is against suffrage because basically they need the legislatures to do their bidding, and they've sort of made themselves very cozy in both Congress and the legislatures of the states, and they don't want that apple cart to be disrupted by an unpredictable electorate. I mean, this would double the eligible voters in America, and they're afraid of what that might mean. So it's so fascinating to see this corporate influence, which, of course, we're dealing with right now. And as Deborah said, all of these issues, the voter suppression, the voter ID, all these restrictions of democracy, which we see at play in 1920, are unfortunately very alive as issues today, and as is this corporate funding of our politics, some of which we can see and much of which we can't.
A lot of echoes in the book, right down to whether rural areas were less likely to be for suffrage than metropolitan and city areas, and how different representatives in Tennessee spun joining the antis because of their views that, more people in more territories of Tennessee might be against it because, you know, the cities might be for it, the rural areas not. It feels so much in many ways like it does have the echoes and the hallmarks of what we talk about in politics today, some of the same kinds of divisions today. It's 100 years ago, the book The Woman's Hour. I want to grab one more phone call before we lose the hour. And this is Carol. Go ahead, Carol.
Oh, hi. I wanted to just comment on Deborah's mentioning about de-escalation of the nuclear arms race, and I certainly supported that, too. I think that what we did through de-escalation of the arms race was we placed restrictions and limitations called arms control, which has proved to some extent, at least in the nuclear area, to be successful. And I think that this is what pro-life feminists want to do with abortion. We want to de-escalate abortion, and I think that pro-choice women, I would think, would want to de-escalate abortion. No one thinks abortion is good. So I think what some women's groups would want to, maybe some women's groups would want to advance abortion. I think, like Hillary Clinton, supporting taxpayers' funding of abortion would certainly escalate abortion. But I think pro-life feminists want to de-escalate abortion through regulations, through educating about fetal development, which, of course, is what the suffragists supported. They also were supportive of education about fetal development and maternity, and Susan B. Anthony ran lectures in her newspaper by Anna Densmore French, who believed that women, if they just understood the development of the unborn child, they wouldn't resort to abortion. So I think if we could at least understand and respect one another, and I would anticipate that neither of Deborah or Elaine would want to advance abortion.
Yeah, and Carol, just let me jump in because we only got about a minute left. Thank you for the phone call. Deborah, some thoughts from you there. Go ahead.
In a minute.
I know.
Yeah, I think the question about strategy, Carol, and thank you for calling. I think there's, we have abortions are happening at one of the lowest rates ever. It's very different in my mind to attempt to pass legislation that makes it illegal for a woman to make a choice or even to criminalize it, because then we're back in the 19th century. Then we have men making decisions about a woman's life and body. And I don't think you and I would be on the same page about that. I mean, I hope that you and I would not be on different pages about that, but I think that that's what it's coming to now in the discussion, and that's why I'm questioning the agenda. Put it on the table.
All right, 30 seconds, Elaine. Go ahead. I know it's tough. Go ahead.
Well, I think what I would like my readers to take away from this book is that this is a book about perfecting democracy, which we always have to be vigilant about. And it's about how activists can create change, but it's hard and it takes persistence. And these women were, I think, the original She Persisted over 7 decades and 3 generations. So I'd like readers to understand how hard this was. Change is hard, progress is hard, but it's very necessary that we undertake it. That's our responsibility as citizens.
Elaine Weiss.
And we must vote.
Elaine Weiss's new book is The Woman's Hour, The Last Furious Fight to Win the Vote. It's out 1 month from today. You can pre-order it now, and you can meet Elaine next Wednesday. Jump online if you want to get tickets to the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House annual luncheon. Where, Deborah Hughes?
SusanB.org.
Thank you so much, Deborah, as always. Great having you here.
Thank you, Evan.
Elaine, see you in Rochester. Thanks for taking the time for the program today.
Thanks so much, Evan. It was a great time to talk to you.
All right. Tim George, Megan Mack, Evan Dawson. Have a great afternoon.